to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm interviewing Roz Morris. Roz has written 11 novels as a ghostwriter, including 8 bestsellers, and has just released her first book under her own name, My Memories of a Future Life. Roz also helps writers with the craft at nailyournovel.com. So welcome, Roz.
Hi, Joanna. Nice to be back.
Yes, great to have you back on the show. Now you are an official novelist and, you know, not just a ghostwriter.
Yes, out from under the sheet.
Yes, so it's an exciting time. So first up, why don't you tell us a bit about the book and give us your elevator pitch and let's see that cover.
Well, here it is. It's called My Memories of a Future Life. It's basically reincarnation in reverse. You've heard of regression to past lives, and I thought, what if you went forwards? That would mean that you were the past. And if you did that, would you be haunting the next incarnation of you? And would it give you the answers you're searching for in your own life for now? The main character, Carol, is a gifted musician who she's never needed anything more than playing the piano, which she does extremely well. And she's never sort of given any thought to whether she's lived before or anything like that. But when an injury forces her to stop playing, she fears her whole life might be over. And she has an encounter with a rather mysterious man who puts her in touch with what seems to be her future self. So if she died and then been reborn, it's her next life. And he is a healer with a secret that he needs to keep. But is he real? Is he a psychological figment? And can experiencing his life through a series of hypnotic trances help Carol find a way to solve her own problems in her life now? And that's the book.
No, it's fascinating, and I've read it, and I think I've used several words like haunting and unusual.
Unusual, yeah, just, everyone says that.
Yeah, it is definitely unusual and slightly disturbing, especially in the regression scenes I found with the mysterious Gene Winter, who I don't know, I quite fancied him in a bit of a dark way.
Oh, you're meant to.
Ah, there we go. I wanted to actually ask you about character development, because I felt that Gene and, in fact, Andrek, the kind of future self, were bigger characters and Carol was a bit more kind of normal. Can you talk a bit about developing characters?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of normality and abnormality in this book, and I had to walk a fine line between making giving it a grounding that would allow me to explore this bigger journey. It's a spiritual journey, a psychological journey. It's a journey to healing. And so I had to be very careful to ground it all well in a central character. So I started with research. Because it's first person, I started with Carol, the narrator, the injured musician. I did a lot of research about what her life would be like if, as a concert pianist, the kinds of pressures it would create, what music would mean to her in her life, how it would govern her entire life, actually. Because if you are a professional musician, you spend a lot of time keeping your craft going, developing your understanding of music, as well as the more peripheral things that we all do as writers, like networking and meeting people and getting gigs and so on. And that is, you know, a whole life's work, and it takes over your life. So I understood that first, and then I thought about her personality and history, because when I was going to take the music away, I had to work out how it would affect her, and I had to decide what kind of person would be most disturbed if that music life was taken away from her. So Once I got that, and I got a fairly strong idea of a person who'd thrown her whole life into music and then had it taken away, I could then write her. And from that, I was then able to develop the other people who she'd have around her, and in a way that would make interesting conflicts and close friendships and relationships, because a lot of this book is, it's relationships. There's Carol's relationship with her flatmate, Jerry, who's a longtime friend, and he's another kind of lost soul character. There are a lot of lost souls in this book. He's very sensitive. He's an artist, and he's very dedicated to that work, but he's not as dedicated as Carol. So he's able to take a bit of a step back from what he does and also have a life. She's not very good at that.
How do you actually do this as a writer? As in, do you have like a sheet that says, you know, this is Carol, her hair is brown and she likes this? And do you have character sheets, or how do you write it down so you remember all about these people as you're writing, sort of meta information?
I think what I did was I did a lot of it started from my research. I didn't so much write down details of people, but I explored them with scenes I wanted to have in the book and found out what would be the most interesting ways for them to behave, and then kept those scenes as templates for key parts of their relationships. I built it all out of relationships rather than from feature lists. Some people do it by interviewing their characters. I did it more by watching what they did if I put them together in different situations. And so from that, I built them from the inside, really. In fact, I hardly decided what Carol looked like. Although I did go on Flickr to look for pictures of people who would kind of embody what I would want if I were to cast them as actors. I found people just in normal photos on Flickr who would have the quality that I was looking for if I saw them from the outside. And those were I just printed them off and used them as little thumbnails to have. And because of what I'd already done, creating their personalities and their lives from the inside, once I'd found the right picture, that then reminded me of them as a person on the outside. And I had them actually spread to my desk.
I do that too. I think having a physical picture is really important, although I tend to choose movie stars because I want them to star in my movie.
No, that's good. I mean, I do that sometimes. There was nobody in this book, but in other books I've done, I've thought, oh, that's absolutely the perfect person to play this. In fact, I made Alan Titchmarsh the Prime Minister of Canada once, because he had the right vibe that I needed for that character. So yeah, celebrities are great, or film roles as well.
Yeah. So this is really a literary fiction novel, in that it's more, like you've said, it's driven by people, relationships, not the sort of plot in a genre fiction sense. Although, would you say that literary fiction is a genre of itself? And you know, what kind of defines that? What makes your book a literary fiction book, I guess?
I think that what makes it literary is that it's as much about the story on the inside as the outside. That's one aspect of a literary novel. And the other aspect is that it seems to ask questions that are bigger than just the particular story that's going on. So I've got a lot of themes that I explore, and questions really that I kind of want the reader to be thinking about. In this particular book, it's what we believe and how a lot of that's created by us, ourselves, the people around us, the people who influence us, people who've influenced us throughout our whole lives. I was very interested in, almost in belief as a process of unconscious creativity, if we want to get really deep and meaningful. But also I wanted it to be a story you could get really involved in, because it is a story. It's not an essay about themes. I always think that if I want to to look at big themes, I find it far more rewarding if someone takes me through a story, makes me ask the questions, while at the same time being involved with some people who are going through a rather difficult time in their lives.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because you know, right now I'm writing prophecy, and I'm writing a lot about whether faith can be manufactured in the brain with neurochemicals and you know, stuff like that. And we've talked a bit about the God helmet idea, and I see that as quite a deep and meaningful theme for what I'm writing. Is genre fiction, it's a thriller, action adventure thriller, but I still want that deep theme. So I guess I'm disagreeing with you that literary fiction has that, is the only thing that has a deeper theme.
Well, no, actually I was going to go on to say that if literary fiction can be much broader than, it's not necessarily an exclusive genre. You can have quite fast-paced, quite heavily plotted novels that seem, that actually ask these questions too. And for instance, a Hitchcock film, you couldn't say a Hitchcock film is plotless. They just rollick along and you're on the edge of your seat. But a lot of them, for instance Psycho, ask all sorts of quite provocative and profound questions about what we do to each other and the unconscious. And so no, all sorts of novels could be literary. It's more a flavour. But I think some purely literary novels tend not to have plots, and that's where they can sometimes get a bad name. And then you also get this dichotomy where people who like very literary fiction almost disapprove of plot. They seem to, and I don't particularly like those kind of books. I like a story that takes me somewhere much further than just a story.
No, definitely. And I guess, you know, since we've got writers listening and many people want to write literary novels, if they are pitching, because you have a lot of experience with, you know, the publishing world and that type of thing, if people are pitching literary fiction, do they say that? I mean, or do they say, like, you know, we've talked about your book is similar to, you know, The Time Traveler's Wife in some sense. Do they say things like, it is like that book? Or, you know, have you got any tips for people wanting to write literary fiction?
Well, if you're pitching it, it depends who you're pitching to, and you should make sure you're pitching it to somebody who is receptive to that kind of fiction. And that also means that you probably don't have to waste words by saying it's a literary novel, because if you're pitching to an agent who is primarily literary, you can assume that that's what they want. Opinions are divided about whether you should say it's like one book or another. Some agents like it and some don't. I suppose I think that if your idea is strong enough, no one's going to mark you down for saying, oh, my book's like The Time Traveler's Wife, when that's not what the agent wants to hear. They'll look most, actually, at what your idea is. So you have to find the way of presenting that as punchily as possible. Now, that really is difficult with a literary novel, because you can severely misrepresent a book if you focus on the wrong things. With a genre novel, it's quite easy, because you can just say it's a story about a girl who finds she's a vampire, she doesn't want to be, and none of her friends are, and she's afraid they're all going to leave her behind, or they're going to stake her, something like that. It's quite clear what kind of book that is. But in a literary novel that has quite a lot of plot, like mine does, because it's got people going to past lives, future lives, it's got a little sprinkling of Jack the Ripper, I could go severely wrong and mislead people if I focused on that. So it took me about 6 weeks to write my blurb so that it did justice to the book. And this, coming back to pitching, it will take a long time for you to write the right pitch for your book. Do expect that it will take a long time, because I've got 100,000 words here, and I've got to condense that into 150 words for a blurb, and even shorter for a pitch. So it takes a lot of sweating. But something else that you can do is look at blurbs for books that are similar to yours, and try to imagine you were writing that blurb for your book. That really helps, actually.
So and we're going completely off topic here, but I'm interested in that. So you wrote your blurb after your book or after. During? Okay.
After, because I had to kind of get to the end to see what I needed to quarry out of it. It's a journey as much for the writer as the reader. Again, this is where it's a bit different from a straightforward, say, adventure story where you know it's going to be, we'll trot through this and that, then this will happen at the end. A book that's more of an internal journey is as much of an internal journey for the writer as the reader. And so once I'd got to the end, I knew what the long-term focus of it was. And at that point, I could pull back and start to write pitches for it and blurbs.
Mm. Oh, and before we get back to other stuff, I just got to ask you as well, because, you know, I'm like, oh, you've written so many books. It's so amazing. How long did it take you to write this book, you know, given how many books you've written before? I know this was a bit different, but, you know, how long are we talking about?
Well, it's actually the first idea I ever had for a novel, and I didn't know how to do it for a very long time. I did a lot of playing with it. Then I went away, wrote a lot of other books, came back to it and thought, I'll have another crack at it because I think I know how to write it now. And so I had a lot of material already, but they were like very rough scenes and so on. I suppose with the various bits of rewriting and reworking that I did, because I did a really strong rewrite on it a few years ago, that took about 6 months. And then I had another quick look at it before I decided to put it out now. And so I polished a few things, shortened a few things. I also had to cut it into four parts. We'll come on to talking about that later. But a book like this, you can expect, is going to take about 2 years at least. And a lot of that is head time with it, with you working out what exactly you want to do with the idea, collecting ideas to see what works with that kind of story and what doesn't. So it's quite difficult to get the two strands to work together, because we have Carol's life in the present, we also have her future life, and there were loads of ways I could have done that, and I had to choose the right way. So a book like this does take a lot longer than a more straightforward novel, because there aren't necessarily as many templates for you to follow about what to do with it.
No, good point. Lack of models, I think, in that area.
Models, yeah, that's a real problem.
Right, okay, right, we're going to get back on topic. So you've got some really beautiful writing, you know, which I would obviously expect from a pro like yourself. But no, really, you know, you're a master of that type of craft. And as you say, you know, spending a couple of years on it, thinking on it so long. How can novices, you know, like myself, improve language to the point that it could become almost a literary genre novel? Because language is part of it too, isn't it? It is aimed at, you know, a higher vocabulary than a lot of novels that are in the airport, for example.
It is, I suppose, aimed at language lovers, because I love language. But not all literary novels have to be beautiful language. They can be incredibly plain. If you look at someone like Hemingway, he'll say something like, I think he was talking, there's a scene where he was talking about someone catching a fish and it made a sound as if someone had thrown a horse into the water. That's not beautiful language. That is a stunning image. So there are many ways to write really well. You have to find what suits you and what you respond to. But it all comes down to reading in an aware way. I've always been the kind of person who can get trapped in a beautiful paragraph. It takes me ages to read a book sometimes, because I just get trapped in there, cycling over and over through a lovely piece of a lovely description. And what I've always done, quite naturally, is go over a piece again and again to try and pinpoint why the writer made me feel a particular way about it. And the more you do this, the more you're developing your sensitivity, like a wine taster developing their palate for an infinite number of flavours. And what I would advise people to do is look particularly for the surprising word, the imagery you've never seen before, because good writing is fresh, because you never seem to have seen it done quite that way. And then ask yourself why it works. And it's like trying to analyze why your gut is reacting in a particular way, figuring out what's being done. And if you read like that, you will develop more awareness. Mm. It takes a very long time, but you will. And that's the best way to do it. It becomes part of the way you express yourself, part of the way you read, and it's natural. It's got to be natural, but it will come naturally the more you sensitize yourself to it. Mm. Also, if you have a day job where you have to write, it can be particularly hard to get into another kind of style, particularly the more linguistically flamboyant styles, more deeply poetic styles. And when I was doing the final edits on that book, I was freelance editing on a magazine, and I had to wrest myself out of a very plain way of writing in order to get into this more poetic style. So I had Faber poetry anthologies beside me on the desk to put me right again. And that really helps. If you find poetry that really gets you into a different way of thinking, that's a quick way of getting out of your day job writing and into the kind of writing you want to put in your novels.
No, I do that too, and I have a stack of these moleskins. You know, I fill these up probably 10 a year, and I take notes like you say, and I do try and take things out of context, so there's never any plagiarism, of course. You know, but I write down words that I might not have heard of before, or, you know, interesting metaphors. And I think even just writing them down, even if I never look at them again, something goes in, doesn't it?
Over time. Yeah. If you make it a habit to be actively noticing that sort of thing, then you won't have to try very hard for long. You will start to just automatically do it. And if you never even look at those again, as you say, the act of writing them down has made them, you know, just a little bit more important than just something you read and never regarded again.
No, absolutely. Okay, so we talked a little bit about research earlier, but I wondered if, you know, for Carol with the musician particularly, which is a very different world, did you do interviews, or, you know, how do you do your research?
Well, first of all, a lot of web research. It's wonderful to be able to do that now. I used to have to buy loads of books.
I thought you said wet research then. I thought you meant like drinking.
Should we take that again?
You said web research, didn't you?
I said web research, yes. It's not a special phrase for writers. Wet research, dry research.
Like murdering people.
Well, yes, and you might have to do some very...
Very wet work.
Burning research in your case. The smell of sulfur.
Anyway.
Yes, I've read what you've written, my dear. But yes, I started with web research, and then I fortunately came across a friend who knew a concert pianist, and I always do try to get to somebody who's really done whatever it is and get first-hand accounts. But I do a lot of research first so that I go to them well-informed. And what I did in this case was I had a lot of questions that I wanted to ask about ways I wanted to use music in the book and assumptions. And for instance, someone had said to me, pianists have shoulders like channel swimmers. And I thought, it'd be nice if they did, but I'm going to check that. And there is actually a line in the book, which is what...
Yeah, that rings a bell, actually.
Yeah, it's what the pianist really said to me. And you'll have to read the book to find out. But so we had quite a long email correspondence where I was asking him questions all about his life as a concert pianist and peripheral things and what school was like, particularly because if you do something like that, you start at a very young age, and so you're different from all the other kids. I went into all sorts of background. He was so generous, allowing me to be really nosy, in fact. But yes, having someone like that you can ask questions to and bounce your assumptions off is very helpful, and you often get something much better when they correct your misconceptions.
Actually, I have another follow-up question on that. It's something I'm thinking about a lot at the moment. How, you know, this verisimilitude, difficult word to say, you know, making things real life, but still we're writing a novel, right, when it comes down to it. Where do you draw the line between researching every tiny, tiny detail to make it sure it's exactly correct, or and where can you just relax a bit?
Well, I think what I do is I get to a stage where I'm comfortable enough with my subject matter to be able to be plausible. You're right, there's a lot that we make up and it is fiction. What I do is I get to a stage where I can fabricate with authority. And that's part of the entertainment anyway. You have to take certain liberties, but I try not to do it in such a way that will spoil it for readers who do know about the subject. Having been a journalist, I'm quite comfortable doing research and being thorough about it, and I find it gives me ideas anyway. For instance, there's a very strange instrument in the book, the enharmonic piano, which is a piano with its black notes divided in two, because musically a sharp note and a flat note are not exactly the same. So if you have to envisage a piano keyboard here, but you have the note D and you have the note E, and on a piano between them is the black note that's E flat or D sharp. But musically, D sharp and E flat are actually different. But because pianos would be immensely complicated if you made them that way, it's averaged into one note. But what I did was I found out while just zooming about the web one day that there was a keyboard that had tried to make the piano with the two true sounds for the sharp and flat. And I thought that would be really ghostly, because it also echoes some of the themes of duality and one note actually being two hidden halves. And I had to put that in. And that's where research can be a joy. That is actually a real thing, the enharmonic piano.
Oh, no, that's good. And I know what you mean. And I found with my research, certainly with Pentecost, synchronicity happens and you think you've made it up and then you haven't. You actually find it, or you find evidence. Weird.
Yes, that does get weird. And then you must have had this too. You get people writing to you saying, "You've written about my life." I thought, no, I made it.
No,
up.
not me, actually.
Well, fortunately not in your case, yes.
No, right, okay, we are cracking on. This might be a long one. I hope everyone's enjoying themselves. Okay, so you, as we've said, you've ghostwritten, you've been involved with traditional publishing, you know the right people, but you have self-published. So what's going on there?
Publishing has changed such a lot. With the economics of the publishing industry now, fewer novels are being published that are adventurous with genre, and if basically a novel won't go in a supermarket, the publishers are far less likely to take it on if you're a writer who hasn't sold under their own name. Now, if I was writing more of my ghostwritten type fiction, I know that publishers would quite happily take novels from me, but that's not what I want to write as me. What I want to write as me is different. I'm quite happy doing both, but as me, the sort of themes that I want to explore in a way that make for more unusual books, and unusual books like that aren't being taken on by mainstream publishing at the moment. But what I think will probably happen is, because a lot of writers are like this, actually, we've all got a much wider range than just the narrow genre that we might be known for. And I know of a lot of writers who are doing their mainstream publishing on the one hand, and then bringing out indie books, which are more their kind of independent projects. It's like in Hollywood, there's this principle of one film for them and one film for you. And that's now what's happening in the publishing industry with wonderful things like the Kindle and print on demand. It means it's possible for writers to spread their wings more.
Which is good for everyone, I guess, you know.
It is. It's, I mean, the, it is great for the art form, certainly, because you get this fresh innovation happening. You get new kinds of fiction, new kinds of story, but you also get the publishing industry managing to sustain itself. It is quite difficult for it now because of everything that's happened.
Mm. Oh, no, that's good. And with the launch, you actually did something a bit different. Why don't you tell us about that? And also, I guess, the pros and cons that you found.
Well, yes, it's been very interesting. I decided I would launch it in four parts. I split the book into four equal episodes because what I was thinking about was, well, Charles Dickens used to publish his novels like that, and it seemed to work quite well. I'd written a book that I knew could split quite well into four parts. Some won't, you wouldn't be able to do this with, but this one did split quite nicely. And feedback from the various friends of mine who read it, who are writing professionals, by the way, not just friends who'd say, oh, it's lovely. they said, oh, it really is pacey, it really moves along. So I thought I could probably get away with putting it out in four parts so that you'd have an emotional cliffhanger at the end of each one and draw people on. So that meant that I could spread the launch out over 4 weeks, and also that I could launch it at a low trial price. So each episode is 99 cents, and that means people are more inclined to give it a try. One of the problems that I had in working out how to market this was that I have a platform, but it's writing advice. Mm. And the people who want to read me talking about writing don't necessarily have the same taste in fiction.
Yeah, so I know that problem.
Yes, exactly. And you have to find ways of tempting them across and just seeing if they'll give it a try. And also the indie book scene is very crowded at the moment. You need to find ways to stand out. So this was another way of managing to just be a bit different and just see what happened. It seems to work quite well because the reviews show that people tried it who wouldn't normally go for that kind of book. You know, I've seen reviews saying, I normally read crime or fantasy or historical fiction, but I really enjoyed this. In fact, someone said, I normally read computer manuals. So that meant it was reaching audiences that a more literary book wouldn't have stood a chance with. So that worked quite well. It also gave me more excuses to tweet about it and generally kind of flit about the blogiverse and Facebook universe with it, because I also had new material to offer. Something that people get very tired of is seeing the same tweets again and again about your book. They think, oh, that old thing, do they never say anything new? I had four different big excuses to be able to tweet about it, and I was also getting reviews every week, so I could tweet those, and it meant it was a far more natural marketing campaign to be able to talk about it and say, oh, there's something new here, and you know, there's a new episode coming up. I could also do launches on Facebook and Goodreads every week, which people wouldn't necessarily say they're coming to them, but they kept the book on people's radar, which was more what I intended. With advertising, what you actually need to aim for is opportunities to see. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that people have the book thrust in their face all the time or whatever it is you're selling, but they've got it in their peripheral vision, so they're always aware of it. Mm-hmm. And since people tune advertising out anyway, that's you kind of expect that, but you have to find reasons to be able to spread it around and get it seen. And then one day, if they happen to be interested, they might take a look at it and go, oh, you know that thing I've been seeing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's marketing. As we say, 50% works. We just don't know which 50%. That's the old adage. No, but what about the cons? One particular con I would see, when I say cons, I mean pros and cons.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I went to write a review on Amazon, and of course, which one do you write the review on? So I think I wrote the review on the full version, but you have reviews scattered across the episodes. Are you going to withdraw the episodes, or how are you going to manage? Because of course, you can't amalgamate those reviews anymore.
No, well, I was wondering what happened. A lot of it was playing by ear to see what would actually transpire. I assumed nobody would write reviews on any of the other episodes. I thought they'd write reviews on episode one.
No, they did, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They wrote them on all of them, which is great. And very exciting for me to get that feedback, actually. Mm. It's been a wonderful experience getting this kind of feedback from readers. And they've also been talking about it on Facebook and a bit on Twitter and emailing me. But, what I'd ideally like is the reviews on the full book.
You have to ask them.
Yeah, I'll be like, I have. Yeah. I'm shameless. And I'm very sorry, everybody. But I just had to put them out there and see what happened, really, and see how people responded. Something that was very nerve-wracking was just after I put the second episode up, I thought, will anybody come back?
Yeah.
Oh, no. And in fact, it was Labor Day in the States when I put it up. And, you know, people were all off. They had much better things to do than come and read a book. So I was a bit anxious about it at first, and then I thought they were starting to trickle back. But another thing that worked to my disadvantage was that people bought the first episode and then didn't get round to reading it, because that's actually how we buy things. I see a book and I think, oh yeah, I've got to have that. My shelves are full of books on my to be read list.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so you have to allow for the fact that people will take time to read it, because they've got lives too. But there were a few people who were reading it straight away and coming back. And what I noticed, the biggest uptake was between episodes 3 and 4. Once people got to 3, they bought 4 as soon as they could. And in fact, the email wires were burning as people were saying, oh, can't you put it up sooner? I want to know what happens. And that was really nice.
Mm. No, that's fantastic. So a good experiment. And what's nice about the indie way is, you know, you can experiment and people, you pretty much do whatever the hell you like, can't you? Because you are in charge.
Another thing you can do, which I didn't realise until I actually was setting up the Kindle files, was you can choose different categories in Amazon for the book to be put in. And again, this comes down to opportunities to see. I put my book in. I put all the different episodes in completely different categories. And that means that they can be seen much further throughout Amazon than if I only had one book. I was getting strange results, like I was number one in hypnosis in Germany. I can have that made on a T-shirt. That's cool.
Brilliant. And why not, you know?
And I didn't realise I could do that until I was looking through the list, putting up my second episode, and I thought, I didn't have to put it in the same one as the first time. Mm. And I put them in categories that would be legitimate. And I was thinking, well, if I was looking for a book like this, where would I want to stumble across it? And there were lots of options. And so I just chose different options for each episode. That's a reason to keep it up there, actually, because people will come across it.
Mm.
And then I've had something that you have to be very careful about is to be very clear, pedantically clear, in the Amazon listing that each part is a part and not the whole book, because I lived in dread of getting a snarky review saying, it's not a whole book. What, it doesn't start properly. What's going on here? Mm. So I had to be very, very clear about that.
Mm. Brilliant. Right. We've covered a lot in this session. So where can people find you and the book and your other books?
Well, I have several places online by now. I used to have just one blog, and that's still my blog. It's Nail Your Novel. That's where I talk about writing, and also occasionally about what's going on with the book. But it's mostly writing tips and posts about self-publishing when I feel something helpful that I can say. And that is nailyournovel.com. I'm also on Twitter tweeting about writing as Dirty White Candy. And the book also has its own blog, which is www.mymemoriesofafuturelife.com. And you can get a free audio there of the first four chapters. That was a great tool, actually. And I got the idea because you do so many podcasts, Joanna. And I love your podcasts. And I suddenly thought, why don't I do, you know, the first four chapters with me reading them and put that out as a free download? Mm. And so I did. And it's got sound effects as well.
Oh, fantastic.
And that's on that My Memories of a Future Life blog. And I'm also on Twitter as by Roz Morris, which is where I tweet a bit about the book, but I also just anything that interests me. It's my kind of informal Twitter chatting presence.
That's brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Roz. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!